Welcome to Awaken Sunday. It's usually Awaken Wednesday. We had a wonderful opportunity and are blessed to be able to take advantage of it. My name is Birju. I will be the chief mic passer of the day. And as a bit of logistical information, so much like a regular Awaken gathering, we started with an hour of sitting. We'll have 30 to 45 minutes for our guests to share. It's an agendaless space. The invitation is to share from the heart. And then we'll have a period of question and answer, which will last until about 4:30, and then we'll plan to close, and there will be snacks afterwards, I believe. So our guest today is Venerable Karma Lekshe. She's a teacher in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition and a professor at University in San Diego, more secular tradition. The first time that she came across the service-based community was nearly 10 years ago when she held a weekend-long retreat on the topics of death and dying, which are core to the teachings of the entire grouping, but specifically in what she focuses on, along with mindfulness and compassion and impermanence, broadly. So, one other piece that I think is important to mention. She's a pioneer in many ways in creating spaces for women to enter into the monastic tradition. And I hope she can share a bit more about that as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Namaste, aloha, and tashidele. So very happy to be back here with all of you after, I guess, 10 years. That's unbelievable. It's been so long, but I've always kept a very warm place in my heart for the group here, the family, and the whole community here. So I'm very happy to see that you're still at it. So waking up, hope we're all waking up, and not only on Wednesdays, and not only on Sundays, but every day. So they asked me to share something about how I got into all of this, and I think I have to blame Nipun that he put that surfing story on the internet, because I've had to live it down ever since. But sometimes people are curious, you know, why an American would get into, you know, a spiritual tradition, the spiritual path, Buddhism, and all of that. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, you know. We're supposed to be getting over the self, and then they ask me to talk about myself. Okay, but anyway, if it's useful. I guess the main reason I got into Buddhism was because my family name was Zen. It was inevitable, I guess, that with a name like that, I think it was spelled Z-I-N-N originally in Germany, but somehow it got changed to Z-E-N-N when they immigrated about middle of the 1800s, and when I was a little kid, my classmates would tease me about being a Zen Buddhist, and then I had to try to find out what that was. This is way back, before most of you were born. And so when I went to the library, I grew up in Malibu, and the nearest public library was Santa Monica, so I went to the Santa Monica Public Library and found two books on Buddhism: The Way of Zen by Alan Watts and Zen Buddhism by D.T. Suzuki. And I read them from cover to cover, and I said, that's it. This is exactly what I've been looking for. And recently I went back to read these books thinking, oh, I must have been really off base, and probably had no idea what they said. But when I went back, actually, I was impressed that these books were really quite solid. So that was probably, that was lucky, I think. But, you know, in those days there were no temples, there were no centers, you know, where people could go. There's very little sort of spiritual companionship. No teachers, very few books. And things that today we take for granted. The idea of spiritual friends and whole shelves full of books on spiritual traditions. And I mean, your generation has it really easy compared to the past. And so I started reading more and more, but I was reading, you know, sort of promiscuously, and I think I got a lot of things really mixed up. But in the end, somehow, it started to come together. And 1964, I took my surfboard and went to Japan to go surfing because this is where Nippon blew my cover. But it was a time when the beaches were getting really crowded in California. And so I thought, well, let's try something else. I had some Japanese-American friends, so took my 9-foot-2 Jacob's balsa board on a ship to Yokohama, from San Francisco to Honolulu to Yokohama. And in those days, the ship was cheaper than the airplane. So, and the four of us landed up in Japan. Now, on the boat, I met a girl who'd been studying in California, a Japanese girl, and she asked me to stay with her family. I was so foolish. I thought everyone in the world spoke English. And it was quite a surprise to land in Japan. I mean, I knew people had accents, but, you know, I didn't quite get it. So I arrived in Japan speaking 3 words of Japanese, which was umi for ocean, sora for sky, and hashi for chopsticks. That was it. And the family that I stayed with were actually Catholic. I was a Buddhist, they were Catholics, and we got along just fine. And they started teaching me Japanese. And fortunately, they lived right next door to one of the largest Zen Buddhist monasteries in Japan. So I would love to go to the cemetery and meditate in the cemetery. I'm not sure what I was doing. You know, I say meditation, but I'm using the word lightly. Probably just spacing out mental wandering. But I thought I was meditating. I was trying to figure out how to get inside the monastery. But I see the monks go up and down. I didn't see any nuns, any women. So I would just meditate in the cemetery. Then I remember that I went traveling. I would hitchhike right all over Japan. I came back speaking like a truck driver. Imagine the fun. And the Japanese family said, oh, no, this is not okay. You must go to language school, Japanese school. So I did. And, oh, many adventures, right? I was teaching English for $2 an hour in Tokyo. These days you get $200 an hour, right? So filed that information. And eventually went to India and, oh, so many adventures. I had a dream that I was a nun on the boat between Yokohama and Saigon. I had this dream that I was in robes and very happy community. And then I thought, oh, that's it. I want to be a nun. But then as I traveled to Malaysia and Thailand, Cambodia and Nepal and India and Sri Lanka, I couldn't find a monastery for women. In those days, it was monks, monks, monks all the way down. Nothing for women. So where am I going to go? And eventually came back to the States. My brother was worried about me wandering out and all over the place. So a couple of years later, I came back and went to school at Berkeley. And earlier, I went to Occidental College and dropped out like Obama, yeah? mainly because they weren't... I was majoring in math. Oh. There's 600 students in the class, 3 girls. And the other 2 were smart. And, you know, we got to differential equations. And I remember very vividly standing up in the middle of the class and saying, I don't belong here. And I left the campus and never went back. Very foolish. And Eventually, though, I came to Berkeley and studied Japanese. But that was the 60s, right? So that was the time when there was lots of action in Berkeley. And we would march for everything. We would march for women's rights, human rights, against racism, peace, and all of this. It was great fun. And, you know, these days people take for granted student representation in university governance, right? Of course you have a student on the committee. That wasn't the way it was before. So, in fact, this Motley Crue made a lot of changes that I think we sometimes need to remember. The whole civil rights movement and all of that. The world is quite a different place for that generation of activists. So this was sort of the awakening of my social consciousness, having been raised in Malibu with all these washed-up movie stars. I remember we used to get paid double Monday nights for babysitting. When they had the AA meetings, we got double. And so many of my friends' parents were famous movie producers and actors, but there were so many problems. So my mother was a Southern Baptist fundamentalist. My father was a Catholic. And so they compromised on Presbyterian. Yeah. Luckily, we grew up in the country. At that time, Malibu was country. So we roamed all over the place and got in all kinds of mischief. But I never thought about my privilege. It never occurred to me. I think there was one black student in Santa Monica High School, class of 1,000, one black student. Yeah. So after traveling, I think traveling is a teacher. We learn so much when we travel. First of all, we have to leave behind our comfort zone. It's the idea of pilgrimage, leaving behind what makes us comfortable and being willing to be uncomfortable. I'm sure this is what Nipun and Gauri experienced in India too, traveling around everywhere. So all those props that we lean on to be comfortable, we have to leave behind and see the world through fresh eyes. And in the process, we also see the sufferings of others, which until that point I'd never even noticed. So in Berkeley, basically, I was trying to translate Japanese poetry. Japanese poetry is really beautiful. It's very succinct. It gives images, especially of nature. And it brings you right into the present moment. Very powerful way of bringing us into the present moment. Art can also do it. Good art, I think, is very evocative. It brings our attention completely into that place and time, nowhere else. But then we got tear gassed out of classes. And there were 68,000 students, but we were only allowed one exit, one entrance to the campus. Maybe some of you remember that, or maybe this is ancient history. And so I started to think about things that had never occurred to me before. So training Aikido, right, and meditating, and then going to the Peace March. So it was, from that time on, I think I recognized that these different spheres of life were not completely divided. They informed each other, but how exactly, I had no idea. So then when I went to University of Hawaii, I went to East-West Center and started studying Asian studies. And there was a Zen center in Manoa Valley, Roshi Aiken. Has anyone heard of Roshi Aiken? Oh, yeah. Okay. He's a Zen master, an American. And that was quite unusual, too. We had always thought of spiritual masters as people that come from other places outside, always male, always, you know, with a particular look, right? But here's Roshi Aiken. He's 6 feet tall, skinny, with a beard, and he's Holly, his wife, right? So, and he was one who had been, he'd been in the army, he'd been a translator in the Second World War, learned Japanese, and also got introduced to Zen. So when he resettled in Hawaii, and a married person, I mean, he was a lay person, a family person. When he settled back in Hawaii, he started a Zen center where people could sit meditation. And they don't do a lot of philosophy in the Zen tradition. It's mostly meditation, what they call sitting or just sit. So that was also very wonderful. But what was most interesting was that he was a peace activist. He was a Zen Buddhist priest and a peace activist. So in Hawaii, then, we got the idea that these were not two separate endeavors, that they actually, I think, in a way, are necessary. That if we talk about compassion, but then we don't practice it, we just sit and meditate on it with no action, it's a little bit weird, yeah? So, in the Tibetan tradition, we say lots of prayers for compassion, lots of prayers for loving kindness, lots of prayers for peace in the world. Sometimes they go on for days. Yeah. In Dharamsala, we'll have these pujas that last for a week, 10 days, you know. And very famous people come, you know, Richard Gere is there a lot. And you know, we didn't even know who he was in the early days. He was just another guy in jeans sitting on the cement in the main temple there. Then they found out he was famous, and they gave him a cushion. So this is sort of my introduction to spirituality and social activism. In Dharamsala also, we're praying so much, I mean every day in fact, for peace in the world. But they're also very much aware of the Tibetan situation of political oppression in Tibet. So the Tibetans who have immigrated to India are the lucky ones, because thanks to the Indian government, which we always keep in mind, they were able to settle, 100,000 Tibetans were able to settle in India. And they said that, you know, they funded schools and, you know, gave land for monasteries and vocational training centers and so many blessings. But the Tibetans left in Tibet were undergoing, so, you know, all kinds of oppression and imprisonment and so forth. So we're constantly reminded that the political and the social spheres are not unrelated. They're interwoven. So our awareness, if we're going to be aware, then that means being aware of all of it. Some people think that spirituality and politics should be completely divorced. The idea of a monk or a nun voting, even, some people think it's really odd, much less taking office. And that's a controversial issue, too, exactly how involved religion and politics should be, because that can also go bad. I mean, look in Japan in the Second World War, where Shinto was sort of harnessed for a militarist government. So sometimes that's a perfect example of, I mean, religious nationalism, where religion is used in the service of less than noble aims. So we do have to be careful about it. At the same time, to imagine a kind of spirituality that's completely divorced from the needs of the world, the problems of the world, is, I think, impossible, really. As we meditate and generate compassion and loving kindness, hopefully that will also spread out. In fact, it can be a perfect testing ground for how great is our compassion. Okay, so it's very easy to sit and think, oh yeah, peace, compassion, love. And then the minute we get up, we're confronted with real life situations, you know, telemarketers and, you know, rude drivers and all kinds of crazy situations, right? Disappointments. with friends and, you know, sometimes uncomfortable work situations and all kinds of. Of course, here in California, we don't have problems. We only have issues. But, you know what I mean. So I think that for me, spiritual practice is really, really important for getting a solid foundation of peace and compassion and loving kindness from which to work in the world. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to be in the world all of the time. I think it's very important to take time out in the day, time out during, you know, the week. That's what the Sabbath was about originally, you know. Sunday was a time of rest where we disentangle ourselves from the affairs of the world. The Hebrew Bible, right? Every Sunday. I grew up with this, you know, in the Baptist tradition, Sunday is the day of rest. It's the day that God had made, and we weren't allowed to listen to the radio or play cards or go in a machine, that's a car, and we weren't allowed to buy and sell, but of course nothing was open anyway in those days on Sunday. It was against the law. And then every 7 years, right, that was not only to give humans a rest, but also to give, animals a rest. Sweet, yeah? Otherwise, we work ourselves to death. We work the animals to death. And then the sabbatical that we enjoy at the university, I mean, actually, I think it's like a mental health thing. Because, you know, after 6 years, you get a break. And that's, I think, a very good thing. So, similarly, if we take time out to meditate or pray, reflect, contemplate, then when we go into the world and we meet these sticky situations, rude people, crazy drivers, you know, I mean, oppressive conditions, and then we can handle better. We can handle better. We won't be successful every time. We can't have too high expectations. The Buddhists call it samsara. Means whenever we have high expectations, we're sure to be disappointed. So we have to sort of get into it gradually and not get terribly disappointed or blame ourselves when we don't live up to our hopes and dreams for being, what's a perfect person anyway? I mean, we want to achieve human perfection, but we can't achieve it all at once. That's a high goal, a very high goal. For the Buddhists consider Buddha Shakyamuni to be an ideal human being, sort of the exemplar of human perfection. But we're not there yet. So we have to give ourselves some space, be loving to ourselves as well when we don't live up to our ideals. So in my case, that was also true. I struggled a lot going to India. I wanted to be a nun. I had to find a place where I could be a nun. And I used to teach. I did everything, actually, in a way. I was a painter and a poet and a yoga teacher. And I used to teach for Bikram. Yeah. Before he went off the rails. Yeah, he was brand new. I knew his brother in Tokyo and another brother in Honolulu. And then when I got to San Francisco, Bikram was just opening up in the Bay. So I was teaching for him then. And then when I went back to India, I said, oh, you've got to stay with my mom in Calcutta. So I stayed with his family in Calcutta. I'll never forget, they would bring a big tray full of barfi and all kinds of Bengali sweets. And then they would have a sweet tea, and then they would have a Coca-Cola. And I was expected to eat the whole tray of sweets. It was, yeah, I enjoyed a lot. And then Vikram's mother took me down to the Mahabodhi Society. And I was trying to find a place where I could study Tibetan. Because I had this East-West Center grant. And it was for studying Japanese, which I'd already done 3 months in Kyoto, and then to study Tibetan. But I wasn't able to get a permit to go to Sikkim. And so where was I going to study? Even I had a letter from the Queen, Queen Hope, but they still wouldn't let me in. So Vikram's mother took me to the Mahabodhi Society, and while we were there, this young American woman came up and said, "Oh, you should go to Dharamsala. You can study Tibetan there." I said, "Oh, okay, great. The Dalai Lama's opened this library. They're offering classes on Buddhism and Tibetan language and everything. Oh, that'll be perfect." So Bikram's mother put me on a train, and 3 days later, I arrived in Pathankot Station, take a bus up to Dharamsala, and started studying at the Tibetan library. So this is really great. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has vision, and he decided that, you know, it would be good to teach people Buddhism, and he appointed these really wonderful teachers, because people were showing an interest, and the Tibetans didn't get it at all, because who are these people? We were a pretty motley crew in those days, with our long hair and our sandals and our guitars and all of that. But His Holiness saw that, you know, this was important. And so he appointed these really lovely teachers for us. And we studied three hours a day, and then on top of that, Tibetan language and so forth. But there was no monastery for women in those days. There were monasteries for monks, and they were just getting on the ground. There was always an idea that being a monk is a very good thing, but being a nun was sort of weird. You know, a woman who became a nun, I mean, either she's too ugly to get married, or she's failed in love, or she's, ding, ding, something must be wrong with her. So it was a long time before I was able to, in fact, in the end, I had to start a monastery. So, yeah. So the nuns would come to me and, you know, they would cry. They wanted to learn Buddhism. They'd walked out of Tibet. Some had walked for 3 days out of Tibet. Some had been children, nuns since they were children, but there was no monasteries for them. So they would look after the cows, the yaks, and the sheep. And they quite liked it because while they were out there, they could say their mantras. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. And then they would herd the cows and herd the sheep. And they weren't forced to get married. In Buddhist cultures, the women do not have to marry. If they want to stay single, they're free to do that. And they can stay in the home. And usually they would look after the children. And then in the wintertime, they'd get some barley flour and they could go off and do a retreat. So that's the way it had been working for many centuries. But somehow it didn't seem completely balanced. You know, the monks would come from Tibet, they get a full set of robes, they get a free education, they get a train ticket down to South India to join one of the monasteries. For the nuns, there was nothing. So we started to set up, first, a literacy program, because I discovered that these women didn't know how to read. And it took me a while to talk them into it. You know, I said, "Well, would you like to learn to read?" "Oh, no. I'm much too stupid." I said, "Oh, no, you can learn to read." "Oh, no. You Western women, you Western nuns, you go learn to read. I'll say, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum." It took me a couple of weeks to talk them into it. And finally, the way I convinced them was to say, "Well, you know, once you learn to read, you'll be able to understand His Holiness's teachings." And I went, "Oh, okay." So then they were really into it. And I found an old lama who would teach them to read. And within 2 months, all of them, even the 63-year-old nun, they could all read. Now, I'm not saying they could understand everything, but they could read, they could keep up with the pujas, and they were so happy. Then they came and asked, "Well, could we learn Tibetan grammar?" And I said, "Well, oh, yes, we can try." So I went around and found a Tibetan grammar teacher, a young layman. And then they said, "Well, could we learn philosophy?" Philosophy. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this was a branch of learning that women had never had access to in Tibetan society. It was considered something much too advanced. And they'd say, oh, nuns aren't interested, women aren't interested in philosophy. But here the nuns were coming and asking to study philosophy. So now that was a hard one, because it was very difficult to find a teacher who would teach philosophy to nuns. It's sort of, in Tibet, the monks' monasteries and the nuns' monasteries were very separate. You can probably figure out why. And so, since all of the advantages were going to the monks' monasteries, the nuns were sort of left without. But if a male teacher, a monk teacher, went to the nunnery to teach, then people would say, what's the monk doing in the nunnery? And there were many jokes and many stories, a whole genre of literature about the monk who sneaks into the nunnery. And it's pretty racy, actually. And so, yeah, so what this did was to leave nuns without teachers. And it took me 2 months to find someone who was willing to teach the nuns philosophy. I circumambulated the mountain. Some of you have probably been to Dharamsala and just circumambulated the mountain looking, asking everyone and just getting pushed off to the next person and the next office and coming up empty-handed. One day, walking through the forest, I saw a young monk who was that I knew, one of these reincarnate lamas, right, Rinpoche, and he and I had the same teacher. So I just saw him on the path, and you know, light bulb. I said, Rinpoche, would you please come and teach the nuns philosophy? He was very young then. If you'll teach me English, I'll teach the nuns philosophy. Deal. So he never did learn English properly, but but the nuns did great in philosophy. They loved it. Now, they were very shy in the beginning. I remember when we dedicated the project, a Nepali Lama had given me the lease to a piece of land. It was called Inji Gompa. That's where the Westerners used to stay. Inji Gompa, Westerners Monastery. And before the sort of the secretaries, it had been actually a cow sheds that had been converted into living quarters for the secretaries of the Dalai Lama and some helpers. And then somehow it came into the hands of Lama Zopa Rinpoche. And then he gave me the lease to that property, $5 a month. Oh, I remember I had to work so hard to save up the money for the rent. Yeah, but we made it. And then the nuns started coming from the Himalayas, and they all wanted to study. And so I would fix up rooms. We had no money for food. Everyone had to fend for themselves. And then there was a huge earthquake. 4 rooms fell down. And I was lucky. I was meditating, and I just jumped under the bed. Otherwise, the wall was ready to collapse on my head. And the living conditions were really poor. In Dharamsala has the heaviest rainfall, the second heaviest rainfall in India. And the place that has the heaviest rainfall, a place in Assam, is the heaviest in the world. So in Dharamsala, it would rain for 3 or 4 months solid. I mean, you could just walk outside the door and take a shower. And you never dried out. Yeah, it was like sleeping in a swimming pool for 3 or 4 months. But we were so determined to learn the Dharma. So we would walk up and down the mountain in the rain and go up and seek meditation teachers way up on the mountains. And it was really great. We really enjoyed. But very difficult time getting visas in those days. Almost impossible for Americans to get a visa. There were something like 38,000 Indian engineering students in the States, and only 3 people who wanted to stay and study in India, but we couldn't get visas. Yes. Finally, I got my congressman on it. Yes. Mm-hmm. Daniel Akaka. I will always be grateful to him. And he got me a student visa. So I was able to stay and study. But then, the first year, long story, because I was wanting to go back to India and become a nun, but I had no money. So the Karmapa had been visiting. A very high lama had been visiting Honolulu. And I asked him, I really want to be a nun. And he said, oh, yes, okay, tomorrow? I said, oh, that would be so great, but I don't have any money at all, and I want to go back to Dharamsala to study Buddhism. He said, that's okay. Whenever you're ready, just come to wherever I am, and I'll ordain you. Oh, great. So there were 13 lamas. I was the cook. Every day cooking for 13 lamas for 2 weeks. It was great. And then the day after they left, then I had to go out and try to get a job. So I'm in Manoa Valley in Honolulu, and it starts to rain. So I just sort of joking, stuck out my thumb, and a car stopped. And he gave me a ride, and you know, he was asking about my background. And then I said, well, what do you do? And he said, well, I'm the personnel director at Kuakini Hospital. And I said, oh, do you have a job for me? And he said, you speak Japanese? Yes. Oh, I've got 3 jobs for you. So just come on down and choose the one you'd like. So I got a job, worked for 6 months, saved all the money, lived on rice and mangoes, and 6 months later I was ready to go to India to get ordained. And, well, long story short, I made my way to Dharamsala and started studying. But after a year, the money that I had saved up was gone. Oh, what to do? So I asked my friend in Honolulu to sell my guitar for me. Right? So $150 he got for my guitar, and I could live another year in India. Yeah. And my mom would send $50 for Christmas, $50 for birthday. So that meant a grand total of $250 to live for 1 year in India. And somehow I survived. But the 3rd year and the 4th year got really difficult. Hungry, very hungry. And then I had a Tibetan family that I used to help by sending boxes of old clothes. They had a restaurant, so when I got really hungry, I'd walk an hour up the mountain and get a plate of noodles from them. But it was really tough in those days. So eventually, while I was struggling myself, I noticed that the Tibetan nuns are struggling even worse, even more, because at least I already had an education. I mean, I already had a master's degree, and I could read and write and read the books and understand the teachings and go to classes and so forth, but they didn't have those opportunities. So gradually this Injigompa, this monastery, developed. We gave it a name, and we invited in teachers eventually. One young student from Oxford said, well, do you think they'd like to learn English? English. Okay. I said, well, you know, 2 months ago they were illiterate in their own language, but I'll ask them. Would you like to learn English? Oh, yes. Yes, they wanted to learn English. So, okay, great. So before we knew it, we had a full-time study program. And they were so happy. They were still very, very shy. When I asked my monk classmates to come up, well, I got to study with the monks because I asked the Dalai Lama, where can I study? And he said, oh, why not study in Sarnath? But he didn't know that there were no nuns studying in Sarnath. There was a great institute called Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies, thanks to the Indian government again. But unfortunately, one monk and one nun had gotten married. So, naturally, they kicked out all the nuns. So, nuns had no place to study. And so I said, well, yeah, I'm afraid nuns aren't allowed to study in Sarnath. And he said, well, why don't you go down here to the dialectic school, the Buddhist Institute of Dialectics, where they do logic and debate. And I'd already been trying to get in for a year, and the principal kept saying, very difficult, very difficult. He wouldn't let me in. But then I said, well, I'm not sure that they want nuns there. And he said, oh, of course they do, of course they do. I'll see to it. So that afternoon, sure enough, here comes the runner. I'm admitted. So I got to study with the monks. And just my bad luck, my entire class were all tall and good-looking monks. You know, and I'm the only nun, right? But anyway, they were all half my age. Of course, one friend said, well, when did that ever stop anyone? But I know she was joking. So I had to really be on my good behavior because everyone's watching this, you know. And eventually, though, the nuns from the Himalayas kept coming and saying, well, we can't all come to Dharamsala, but we want to study too. Could you help start a study project up in Kinnoor, in Spiti, in Ladakh, in Zanskar? So gradually, that's how it started. We would send $1,000, and some books, and then see if they would form a community. They could all study together, find a teacher. And these days, we just go to a valley and say, okay, who knows the most Buddhism in the valley? And they'd say, oh, that would be Tashi Tsering. Where's Tashi Tsering? Oh, he's in a cave. Let's go. So we go to Tashi Tsering, you know, and make prostrations and offer him a pile of money and please teach the nuns. And, oh, no, I don't know anything. Eventually, you know, after 2 hours of cajoling, finally he would agree. And that mama stayed for 6 years, taught the nuns for 6 years, and they all of these projects with the $1,000, they really made the best of it. We come back a year later to see what they did with it, check the accounts and everything, and they all did very well. But 6 years later, Tashi Tsering came to me and he says, I taught them everything I know. Now I'm going back to the cave. Okay, well, he'd really done his job. And so this is the way we grew, and it's just been very organic, sort of like your group here. You know, one step after the other. And eventually now we've got one monastery. The very first monastery has 140 nuns. And they recently, last year, took the Geshe exam, which is the highest degree in philosophy. And it'll be the first time in history, world history, that women have taken this degree. So we would love to have lay girls also studying there. But it's strange in Himalayan cultures, if you're really interested in Buddhism, you just naturally want to be a nun. So I try to convince them to stay as nuns. But the minute I leave, they shave their heads and put on robes. And what can I do? So I've also tried to keep them in school. They should go to school at least for 10 years. That's very good, you know. They say, okay. And the minute I leave, they all go to the monastery. So, but it's their culture, and I have to be very careful of imposing my cultural values on them. They're not interested in secular subjects. The schools are not in their own languages, right? They're not teaching anything they're interested in then, and they want to follow the spiritual path. Well, how can I forbid them to do that. I mean, it's natural for them to do that. So it's all been lots of fun. And I've just been in Bodh Gaya. We now have an institute in Bodh Gaya where they can come down from the mountains in the winter months where it's freezing up there. I mean, sometimes it gets to 20, 40, 60 below. And they're just under, 10 feet of snow. And it's too cold to do anything. I mean, it takes 4 hours to boil a cup of tea up there. So we started a small institute in Bodh Gaya where they can come down during the winter months and study, and they're so happy. So I've just been there teaching them English. And Dipti knows all about this. Dipti has gone up and helped me for 2 years to visit all the monasteries and do the accounts and distribute the donations and so forth. It's very, very helpful. Oh, really? Yes. Okay. Well, Dipti I met here 10 years ago, and she's another one who has dedicated her life to service. Highly intelligent, highly educated young woman who has been in India now, I guess, for 8 years, working with various projects, especially water management projects. And recently, she's now, I guess, 3 years, she's been back working for International Rivers over in Berkeley. And so she goes back and forth, that her entire life is dedicated to service. So I really admire her, and she's been very helpful for our projects. And so it just shows all of the connections. People, good-hearted people who want to help the world also help each other. And it's been so wonderful to see that, you know, our international connections now, too. Many stories, but all I can say is that it's working and that there's been many changes. And I'm just working in one little area of the world. We also have these two schools in Bangladesh, where, as you know, there's about a 1% Hindu minority, 1% Christian minority, 1% Buddhist minority in Bangladesh. And the Buddhists are along the Burmese border. And it's a very remote area. And before, the girls were not sent to school. But now we've got two schools going, and we could start dozens of schools. but at least we do what we can, right? Start where we are. And but it's so heartwarming to see these young munchkins, you know, come in so tiny and so sad. And then after a couple of years, they're healthy and happy and smiling, and they really work hard because they, you know, my students in San Diego, I'm teaching very privileged students, and they don't, I mean, they just sit there like, and, you know, they don't realize their good fortune to get the opportunity. And it's as if their parents are forcing them to study and they don't really want to be there. But it's quite the opposite, exactly the opposite with these young girls. They just race into classes and they're just like this, and oh, they're so happy to have the chance to study, right? And one pen, oh, it's such a treasure for them, one little notebook, and very cute. So there are some brochures if people want to learn more about that. But I'd like to, you know, I think I did my duty. And so, I'd like to open it up for your reflections and dialogues and dialogue. And yeah, I'm sure each one of you has a story equally as interesting. And together we can save the world. So,
thank you so much for sharing. And just as a bit of a dovetail off of what was just shared, right around the corner you will see some brochures on a couple of the organizations that Karma Lekshe was speaking to. And as you're heading out, please take a look. Can I start with the first question?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just to be specific on what you're up to right now as a teacher, both in the university context and beyond, can you just share a little bit more about what that looks like?
Sure. So I'm teaching Buddhism to the Catholics at University of San Diego. Yep, I have 100 victims every semester. And my subversive agenda, of course, is to wake them up to help the world. And when I first got this job, I mean, I came in as a lowly postdoc after finally finishing my dissertation. And was asked to teach Buddhism and world religions. So I enjoy it a lot. 8 months of the year I'm there and teaching world religions, but with the subtext of wake up. And of course, cultural diversity. My main objective is to help them see the world in different ways. So that's the beauty of world religions. You're teaching much more than religion. You're teaching all about values and different ethical value systems and the commonalities and differences among them. So it's a great forum. It's a platform, basically, for teaching everything under the sun. And also I teach Buddhist thought and culture, which is a survey course, starting with the history of Buddhism, then the philosophy, then the cultural development of Buddhism in so many different countries, and then ethics, especially Buddhist social ethics and questions such as gender and economic ethics, political ethics, and all of these topics. I also teach death and afterlife. Okay, so death is a good measure of our lives, isn't it? As we 10 years ago took up that topic. But if we really understood death, maybe we would live our lives in a different way. And looking at death from many different cultural perspectives. So that's sort of what I'm up to. And although grading papers is a challenge, but I think it's really worth it. Working with young people. And, of course, this generation is coming from a very different place. And you have to design classes to keep them engaged. The attention span is about 10 minutes long, so you have to try many different things to keep them engaged. And, of course, that's good. It keeps us young, right? And then in the breaks, I go to many different countries, wherever I'm invited to give talks or participate in conferences, but also because every 2 years we organize an International Buddhist Women's Conference somewhere in the world. So the next one will be in Indonesia. I warmly invite all of you to attend. Borobudur, a beautiful mandala, the biggest mandala and biggest stupa in the world. And it's a marvelous place, beautiful country. And so I'll go to prepare for the conferences, and we try to hear all the voices. Men are welcome at the Sakyadita conferences. People of all cultural, religious backgrounds are welcome, and it's a great sharing of experiences. Some of the conferences have been small. Some have been as large as 3,000 people. So it's really fun. And so that's basically, that's the main things I'm into.
Thank you. And if you can raise your hand, I will walk on over and we can go and have some back and forth.
I don't know if this is a silly question, but you said that you have a surfing background.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's any way in which anything about surfing has a kind of actual connection with the things you've been talking about. Oh, I'm Richard.
Yes, Richard, I think that there is a connection between surfing and spiritual development. At least there was for me, because I found that sitting out in the ocean gave me a different perspective on the world. It's also a quiet space between sets, right? You're quiet. You're surrounded by the ocean. And so you have time to reflect on life. And I think that's really valuable. I wouldn't say it's a religion. Surfer Magazine interviewed me and tried to get me to say that surfing is a religion. I couldn't quite go that far, but I do think it's very spiritual. But of course, which is why I eventually went to Japan to go surfing, is that it became quite competitive. There were too many people, and the beaches were too crowded. And then sometimes we used to have an ethic where we would share waves. You know, you take that one, I'll take the next one, sort of thing. But now they all try to jam up on the same wave, and it's a mess. But I do think that taking time, and of course you can do this in the forest, in nature, anywhere. I think that that's one reason that people have gotten away from themselves, is that many of the young people have never been introduced to nature. So I take them up to Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh's monastery. It's called Deer Park Monastery. They have about 250 acres. And many of them say it's the first time they've experienced something like that. And it's very illuminating for them. So I think getting young people out just to walk in nature is very important. That's my experience. Yeah. Now, Japan was really nice. You know, sweet little waves. And again, there was no one out. It was empty. The beaches were empty. We held the first international surfing contest ever held in Japan. I was the only girl. And now, of course, it's become really big. But in those days, it was really nice. So, yeah. Surfing is spirituality.
Can you share a bit about the story of and when you were out in the jungles of the Himalayas and your own brush against mortality and, you know, likely death. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I'm virile.
Right. Well, I had a few close calls, but I think the snake bite was the closest. I was looking, these mud huts in the forest are really falling down, and I was looking, and there were too many nuns, so I was looking for a place where we could settle. And I was looking at different pieces of land, and a friend said, well, come to this village and I'll show you some land. And as we were walking around one piece of land, we got this creepy vibration, creepy sensation. But the way out was very long, so we ducked under some brush. And I felt something fall on my shoulder, but I didn't see anything. And after we left that property and I went up to get the bus with my friend, I felt really very sick, right? I made it back to the monastery and collapsed. And the next day, the Tibetan doctor found a bite on my shoulder. And he didn't know for sure whether it was a scorpion or a spider or a snake or what. There was no way to know at that time. But he knew that I was in a life-threatening situation. So he gave me some special medicine against poisons. And I survived the bite. But 8 days later, I was getting sicker and sicker. And I actually, by that time, had gangrene. So my whole arm was black, like saran wrap on shiny black. It was when you have gangrene, the infection builds up and kills the cells. And in the American Southwest, they used to just sort of slice the affected area and let the pressure out. But they didn't know to do that in Dharamsala. So my whole arm was gangrene, and they took me to Delhi to amputate my arm. Well, when I got to Delhi, I guess I was too serious. Nobody wanted to take the responsibility because they thought I was going to die. So they just left me, and somehow I survived. And yeah, they all told me when I left the hospital 6 weeks later, they said, none of us expected you to survive. I think, thanks, guys. But, and then my friend said, because there was a malaria epidemic, there was a viral epidemic, I knew I had to get out of Delhi, but where to go? So I called a bunch of friends, and one said, just fly to LA, I'll take care of everything. But they wouldn't let me on the plane alone because I was really in a life-threatening situation. And this angel appeared, Erica. She was one of these people who meditates naturally. I've known four in my life, all women somehow. From morning to night, that's what they do. They meditate. So Erica was like that. And it was so wonderful to have her in the hospital room, because she and the nuns would just sit and meditate all day. It was very comforting, right? Yeah, very kind. And she offered, even though she hadn't been back to the States for 7 years, she offered to go back with me. So we got to L.A., and then my friend said, okay, I'm going to take you to Tijuana. What? So, and she was a doctor, and I'll never know why she took me to Tijuana. And put me in the hospital down in Tijuana. But the only problem is they didn't have any vegetarian food. Yeah, and at that time, my protein count is supposed to be 40, right? My protein count was 4. I was barely alive, but somehow they did the skin grafting, and I can't complain because I'm alive. So there were many teachings that I learned through this. One is that life is impermanent. You know, I've been meditating on this for a long time. It's one of the most basic Buddhist teachings, because remember, the sight of a corpse is one of the things that turned the Buddha to the spiritual path. And so they meditate on death a lot, death and impermanence. And I've been doing those meditations also for years and years, but when it happens to you, it's different. It becomes real. And from one day to the next, for 3 months, you don't know if you will be alive tomorrow. That's a real teaching. The other thing I learned was that I really needed to do a lot more meditation. You know, meditating in a nice warm space with nice friends when your stomach is full or half empty, and the weather's great, and that's one thing. But meditating when you're in torturous pain and you don't know if you're going to be alive from day to day is quite another. Plus, another thing that I'd never reckoned with was that they give you a lot of drugs. Well-intentioned, I'm sure, antibiotics and all of that, but also pain medications. And those pain medications actually dull your awareness. So you're trying to meditate, but you can't focus. And finally, I asked the doctor, they just come and give you a big handful of pills, right? I said, what are they? Oh, it's just Valium. Valium? That's bad for your mind. So I stopped taking that, and, you know, little by little. But so learning that we, in order to control the mind, we really have to practice seriously for quite some time. We can't expect that we're just going to suddenly be able to concentrate, especially under those kinds of dire circumstances. The other thing I learned was a lot about loving kindness. You know, that if when you're in a life-threatening situation like that, you're completely dependent on the people around, even for a glass of water, for everything. And so, you know, we really do owe a lot to each other and those who help. And I'd never really thought about it, you know. Handicapped people, yeah, they get special parking, but I'd never imagined what it really meant to be handicapped, to put myself in that position of being completely dependent on others for every little thing. So that was really a good wake-up call. And I think that the meditation on loving kindness was the most helpful. Also, just sort of taking refuge. You know how the Buddhists go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and just putting yourself in the hands of, maybe from a Hindu perspective, the hands of God or the hands of your favorite God or whatever, right? And so the Buddhists, you just kind of imagine your head resting in the lap of the Buddha, something like that. It was very comforting. Yeah. So that's my experience, and of course there's much more to tell, but yeah, so I think meditation on death and impermanence is really important.
Mm. I'm Dinesh. I know we had a whole retreat on the process of death and understanding death and the afterlife. But I wanted to, for the benefit of those who had not attended that, if we can give the main reason why we shouldn't be afraid of death. And so that part of the understanding, if you can elaborate on.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, from a Buddhist perspective, we should be a little bit afraid of death. The Buddhist is always going to stir the soup a little, you know. Because we don't know what our future will be. It depends very much on how we live our lives. And so it's kind of this reflection on death and impermanence. It's kind of a reflection on, you know, waking up to our situation. We don't know if we have another year or another decade or another day. We have no idea. So, again, the idea of living our lives in a way that will help us to die well. So they say, if we practice Dharma well, we sleep well at night and die without regret. Isn't that great? So maybe this is the essence of karma, the law of cause and effect, to have no regrets. And if we can remember that, I think that we will live well and we will also stand a good chance of dying well. But they will start on a molecular level and recall that we've actually been dying since we were born. We're dying constantly. Every cell in our body is arising and perishing, moment to moment. So it's not like birth here, death there. It's a process. We're in the process of dying all the time. But death in South Asian traditions is not final. We have something over the border there. And so that's where the controversy comes, you know, what exactly is going to happen to us. But most of the South Asian traditions also recognize this law of cause and effect, that if we create wholesome actions, we will experience pleasant results, and these will carry over to future lives. So whether it's a soul that travels from lifetime to lifetime or simply an impermanent stream of consciousness, South Asian traditions all agree that we're not just going to stop and the end. Teaching this death and afterlife class, I went around to see what they believe. And about 8 out of 25 said the end. That's it, folks. But most people in Asian traditions don't necessarily agree. And logically speaking, the idea of just a final break, they would say, well, every cause gives rise to a result. Every cause has a consequence. Now, of course, the opposite is true. The negative deeds that we do also have consequences. So that's why we have to be careful of our actions of body, speech, and mind. To live, to be careful, to pay attention, to be aware of what we do, say, and think. And the Buddhists are going to take it even, you know, thoughts have consequences. So these kinds of things. So in a way, if we live a good life, we have nothing to be afraid of. Right? No doubt our future will be pleasant. Is that good?
My name is Rajesh. You mentioned waking up quite a few times and wanted to know what that means.
Ah, good. Well, I think the Buddhists talk about waking up as the final realization of a perfectly awakened Buddha. Someone who has eliminated all greed, hatred, and ignorance. All greed, all hatred, and all ignorance. Meaning a Buddha is omniscient. If you get rid of every trace of ignorance, then you would know all things. And they claim that a Buddha knows all things at all times. The Mahayana Buddhists further claim that we can all achieve this state. In other words, that we can all achieve perfect awakening. And not only that, not only we can, but we will. It's just a matter of time. So one of my teachers used to say, the only difference between us and Buddha Shakyamuni is that we're lazy. Yeah. From another perspective, though, we can think about waking up moment to moment, being completely in the moment. And that makes sense, too. If we can just get rid of greed, hatred, and ignorance in this very moment, we'll see the world through new eyes, completely new eyes. So each moment is extremely precious. But usually we miss it because we're mulling over the past, we're fantasizing about the future. Rarely are we completely in this precious moment. That's why Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese poet, monk, wrote the book Present Moment, Wonderful Moment, right? To remind us to be in this very moment. He tells this story, and I used a book called Pieces Every Step in my World Religions class last semester, and he tells this adorable story of when he was a kid, 4 years old in Vietnam, and his mom went to the market, and she brought back a cookie. So he took his cookie out on the front yard, and he stretched out his legs and he enjoyed his cookie for 4 hours. So cute. Yeah, he was really into the cookie, you know? Totally in the moment, moment to moment. So it's that kind of wake up experience that we have access to all the time. But how rarely do we take advantage of the opportunity? We're always buzzing around about what we've got to do, what we didn't do, what we should have done. What? Yeah. So, so it's time. I mean, that's if we wake up, you see. And the other good part about that is, if we're completely in the moment, we're not going to get off on some of those sidetracks, greed. You know, what is it? One more thing, right? Anger. Why bother? Mess up the moment. Anger's not a fun thing. The Tibetans describe it very, very cute, you know. We get red and we get hot and even our ears get hot and we get ugly. And right? So what's fun about that? Why do we do it? So if we thought of the logic of it and then we're just aware, pay attention moment to moment, And especially to pay attention when we feel those kinds of negative emotions arise and catch it before they take over. We control our emotions. We don't have to be controlled by our emotions. That's the deal. Okay, so waking up to the moment.
I'm Sri. Thank you for this talk. It's been great. As we accompany loved ones or parents that are going through the process of death and dying, especially those that aren't kind of initiated in a tradition, are there techniques or things that, you know, practices that can allow for a good or better death?
Oh, for sure there are. We should try to make them as comfortable as possible. And that would be according to their standard, not our standard. Right? We should try to avoid disturbing them. And that would include, you know, raising uncomfortable issues about the past. Unless they initiate them. If they want to talk about stuff, we can engage, but carefully. If they're on a spiritual path, it makes it quite easy because all spiritual traditions have techniques that will help. They might recite mantras, they might say prayers, they might whatever is useful, or even watching the breathing. Now, watching the breathing can work for people who don't have a particular spiritual path because there's nothing religious about breathing. But it can be very helpful when people are in pain or facing uncertainty. As I mentioned in my own experience, part of the difficulty of dying is the uncertainty of it. And by staying with our breathing, it's a way of bringing us into the moment, relaxing us, and keeping our mind off distressing thoughts. So that can be very, very helpful. If they're ambulatory, we can take them for a walk in nature. It's a good way to get their mind off the pain or the dissatisfaction. Dying is not always a pleasant experience. I mean, it's usually not a pleasant experience. And if people don't have tools for dealing with it, so the way many people live does not prepare them for dying. And it means leaving behind everything that they hold dear, their loved ones, their possessions, their all of their hopes and dreams. So I think we have to be very patient, extremely patient. That's a practice in itself. It's a challenge, yeah. Do your best.
Hi, my name is Mega. Thank you so much for sharing your story. I was particularly interested in all the pioneering work you've done as a woman. And I was wondering, like, do you feel complete acceptance in terms of practicing Buddhism as a woman? And are there any cultural kind of difficulties that you're encountering right now? Because I've always viewed Buddhism, or it's always been presented as more of a gender-neutral spirituality to me. So it's really interesting to kind of have your perspective. And I was just curious, because I taught a class at Cal when I was a student with some friends on women and Sikhism, and we found all of these, you know, in the religion itself, it's very egalitarian, but then culturally, you know, there are all these influences that kind of skew the perception of women, and so how do we kind of bridge that? And I was wondering if you had the same experience, and, you know, if there are any, like, remaining obstacles, like, what can we do, and how can we kind of improve the situation?
Okay. Well, that's a big one. Like Sikhism, the Buddhist tradition claims that it is gender neutral. That in the nature of the mind, there is no male and female. Everyone has the opportunity to achieve liberation or enlightenment. But the social realities don't generally match the rhetoric. And so we have to, what are we going to do? So I mentioned, you know, some of the inequalities in access to the knowledge and conditions for practice. So these are very practical obstacles that I personally faced as a student in living in Dharamsala all those years, 15 years. And seeing that the monks got every opportunity, but the nuns did not. And how do we deal with that? So resentment doesn't really help. And that's why I decided to just, right? It just, you make yourself miserable. But changing conditions is what, you know, I thought, well, let's just do something about it. And that's what really helped. That really. But sometimes I must say it was rather discouraging. And you would get discouraged, but then that doesn't help either. So just try to go beyond, you know, our own personal expectations. And also to question. I questioned a lot of the lamas. You know, if you say that men and women are equal in Buddhism, then why is this passage say that women are, you know, temptresses and, you know, backstabbing and this and stuff? What? That's in the Buddhist text. So the Buddhist texts have very positive images or representations of women, but they also have some that are not so positive. How did they get in there? If the Buddha's enlightened, didn't he understand that we're all human, we all have greed, hatred, and ignorance, and we can all get over it? So what is this? And you see what they say, but not confrontationally. In my experience of living in Asia, confrontation doesn't work. It's actually counterproductive. But gently, respectfully, sometimes it's important to ask the questions. So in Dharamsala, the people would come and ask me, well, you're a Westerner. Where are the Lady Lamas? Where are the Lady Lamas? I said, you know, you have an appointment with His Holiness the Dalai Lama this afternoon. Why don't you ask him that question? Very subversive. And so this happened a lot because I would meet a lot of Western people who were fortunate to have audiences with His Holiness. And then I would say the same thing. So he kept getting this question, you know, where are the Lady Lamas? And then, you know, he started thinking about it. And I think now a lot of people are thinking about it. And by having to confront the question or think about the question, things have really started to change, both in Asia and in the West. And in the end, we all have to take care of our own minds. If we're full of greed, hatred, and ignorance, we can't blame it on men, right? Or women, or anyone else. It's our responsibility. And we all have the same tools. Now, we're all literate. We can read the books. We've got access to these brilliant tools for how to control anger, how to get over, you know, our constant, you know, habits of acquisitiveness and attachment and all of those sorts of things. So no excuses, yeah? So, okay, conditions still are not equal, but we're working on it. So, much more to say, but, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. My name's Mark. I'm curious if you can share of any interfaith experiences in which you might have been involved.
Oh, I've been fortunate to be involved in lots of them. I mean, living in India is a daily interfaith experience. Yeah. And in addition, I got involved in interfaith dialogue in Hawaii in the 70s. And then I remember one time in Dharamsala, I was staying in a group of Catholic monastics came to Dharamsala. And there were three monks and three nuns. Naturally, they're American, right? So they would send three of each. But our school had 80 monks and only one nun. So when these nuns showed up, they didn't know what to do with them. So, you know, here comes the runner, and, you know, the principal wants you to come, so I go down, and then, oh, very happy to welcome them. So the first question, you know, they said, well, so how are you doing on the gender issue? Said, I'm pretty good. You know, His Holiness has said that we could go and get full ordination if we want to. They don't have it, but we can go to Korea or Taiwan and get it. How about with you folks? They said, under the current Pope, hopeless. Hopeless. So these kinds of dialogue, I think a lot of the dialogue is on an interpersonal level, you know, discussions with friends and in the classroom as well. But also I think the forums, the interfaith dialogue forums, are very important. I've been to the Parliament in Melbourne. Over 600 sessions of all every religion in the world. Amazing. So much to learn. And now some people criticize this. They say, well, these interreligious conferences, it's just, you know, we're just talking to each other. The prejudices among, you know, the vast majority of people continue. But I still think that the interreligious dialogue is important, because the more people who are informed, the more, the better we can help correct misconceptions. Of course, I'm very fortunate to be teaching world religions, and that's an opportunity for me, especially teaching at a Catholic school, to try to bring in different religious perspectives on different issues. So it's marvelous. But I think we can use every day as an opportunity to further interreligious understanding, and I hope we all will, if when the opportunity arises. I'm not suggesting that we be interfaith missionaries, but when the opportunity arises, it's good to. Now, what do you do when people come out with some really blatantly discriminatory statements? That's hard. But I think gently to try to correct some of the misinformation. You know, this group, they're all violent. This group, they're all this, that, the other thing. Sometimes we can preempt it, you know, by talking about the peace efforts of the various religious traditions, which is not to erase the problems. Heaven knows we have enough problems, and all the religions are complicit. I mean, there are, unfortunately, violent elements in every religious tradition. And as a Buddhist now, it's so embarrassing. You know, first Sri Lanka, then Thailand, then Burma, you know. Oh. But, okay, so all the more that we, important that we try to work step by step to understand each other better. That's my experience.
Hi, I'm Nandini. I'm really happy to be here and very inspired by your story. I was actually curious about when you said you had a dream that you wanted to be a, or in a dream you saw yourself as a nun. I'm wondering if there were, if there's a story or a moment where you kind of had to make that decision between becoming a nun versus being, or journeying in the spiritual path as a lay person, and if that was a struggle that you had to kind of journey through before the choice that you made, and if you could share that.
Well, for me, becoming a nun was really important because I found it very inconvenient to be a single woman, in, especially in this society. You know where I'm going with this, yeah? But as a with a bald head, nobody asks you out on a date. So it's a great freedom. And I don't have to worry about that. You can be friends with men without any, you know, subtext. So for me, it just was the most comfortable way to practice. But I'm not saying that everyone should be a nun. No, it's very possible to be a great spiritual practitioner. Some are fortunate enough to find a partner who is encouraging and supportive of that. And I think that's important. If I were to, you know, advise young women who would like to have families, I would say it's really important to try, or young men who are trying to find a life partner and have a family. I think it's very important to try to find a partner who really cares about the spiritual path in whatever form that may take. Because and then, of course, we're fortunate that we have the freedom to remain single if we like. In some societies, it's just next to impossible. But in a contemporary American society, and it wasn't always like this. When I was a kid, it was just taken for granted. And not to marry was considered something very weird and something quite bad, actually. But now it's quite different. So that's a kind of freedom, too. For me, though, you see, it wasn't just about practicing the Dharma. It was about practicing full time. not just on one night a week or two nights a week or something like that. I wanted to get on with it. And the Tibetans, you know, talk about death so much that after a while it starts to affect you. You know, oh, clock is ticking. Got it. And I, ever since I was a kid, I've been working on this, but finally I had the tools to really do it. I got the directions, you know, begin at the beginning and proceed until the end, and just wanted to get on with it, right? And then you don't have time for a lot of this other stuff. So it's just my experience. I'm not, you know, parents, please don't get worried. I'm not trying to steal your daughters. but it's, yeah.
We have time for one last question because there is, and I'm really sorry to cut it off, but we'll have to send them off on their plane flight, which is relatively soon.
My name is Supriya. Thank you so much for sharing your journey so far. And my question was about a similar question. How does one become a karma yogi, the way we define in Hinduism? Mm-hmm. You live your life, but at the same time you find your spiritual path. How do you strike the balance?
Okay. I think there's a tension that runs through all religious traditions between contemplation and social service. What you're implying. And I think that that's not an easy thing to work out, because the needs of the world are so great that when we start to get involved in social service, there's no end to it. So we have to find a balance, and we have to be very honest about it, taking time for contemplative practice, whatever form that may take, and then also making time for service in the world. The Tibetans have an interesting perspective on it, which is that we could give soup in the soup kitchen all day, but tomorrow there are going to be hungry people again. And so they talk about ending the cycle of samsara altogether. That we can provide the fish and we can teach the people how to fish, but it's not going to solve the problem completely. In order to solve the problem completely, we have to figure out how to get out of the wheel of birth and death. So, and so we have to balance. We need to work on our spiritual development in order to figure out how to get off the wheel. But we can't ignore the sufferings of the world. And sometimes they think that karma yoga and dealing with the sufferings of the world is also an important practice. It's not just time off. It's also a time when we have to deal with our own mind and the personalities of others, not just the reciprocants of our generosity, but also the people we have to work with while we're doing that. And so that's a practice too, letting go of our own expectations. Oh, we can't have our own way every time. And when we work with people in the world, we learn that. I mean, some people learn that. I should say we practice with that, right? And we also learn that by insisting on having our way all the time, we're making ourselves miserable. That is a spiritual practice. So we take spiritual practice in the larger sense, that it's not just about doing puja. It's not just about sitting in front of the altar. It's not even, you know, just about serving humanity. It's every waking moment. Being honest about our thoughts, being honest about and trying to be careful of our words. We make so much problem with this mouth. Oh, really? One word and we can lose a good friend. One word and we can make a big mess. We can lose our job, you know? So, of course, our words and our actions proceed from our minds. So if we clean up our mind and can get rid of, I mean, I'm saying greed, hatred, and ignorance endlessly, but I also mean pride and jealousy and all that other yucky stuff. We can use every opportunity to work on that. So, balance. And I can see that, I sense that all of you are doing that. And I really appreciate it. And I appreciate all of you who give people the opportunity to do that. And I think that it's wonderful you have a group where you can support each other in doing that. So thank you so much. Please carry on.
This space, as was just mentioned, has been held for some time now, 16 years. And the Awaken community has been built off of holding space for these kinds of discussions. And, it's done very much in a no-strings-attached sort of manner. So there's a lot of gratitude in the circle for that type of space being held. We end our circles with 2 minutes of gratitude to radiate that outwards and to feel that inwards. As we head into it, if I may make a request, in the tradition that you are following, is it possible to share a chant as we head into our silence?
Sure, sure.
And Dinesh Uncle will ring a bell in 2 minutes after.
Okay. In the tradition to which I am accustomed, we do a practice of rejoicing in the merit. So whenever we do a good deed, we feel happy about it. Right? Usually we're beating each other, ourselves up for, you know, blowing it. But we also have to remember to appreciate ourselves when we do good things. So say, taking 2 hours out of our Sunday, it's Sunday, yeah? Our Sunday afternoon to come to the center and try to work toward awakening. This is really good. You've done a really excellent thing with your time. And so we appreciate ourselves, we rejoice, and then we share the merit of our practice with all living beings throughout time and space. And so I'll say a short prayer in Tibetan, and then, yeah. Ngewa di nyu du dan lama sange du kyu ne do wa chi kya ma lu pa ke ki sa la By virtue of the merit that I've accumulated here today, may I achieve the state of perfect awakening quickly in order to liberate all living beings from suffering, leaving not one behind.